Scott Stevens is the ABC's online editor for religion and ethics. Scott's made this religion and ethics web portal on the ABC a real global focal point of discussion and ideas about religion, power, faith, and atheism. And it's a seriously provocative place. I go there quite often to read stuff, and if you're interested in such things, you should definitely take a look. abc.net.au/religion. Scott Stevens is his own man, and I can never confidently predict Scott's view on so many things. He works a couple of desks down from me at the ABC, and I'm always holding Scott up from productive work by, you know, just wandering over to get his thoughts on something that I happen to be working on. Scott's point of view is informed, of course, by the range of his reading and research, and also by his background, which is kind of interesting. Scott's originally from the United States. His dad was a very religious man, and also a pioneer of robotic engineering. His dad joined the CIA for some years, and then after a while became disillusioned and left the agency in disgust, and took the family to lead a simpler life in the Solomon Islands. And it was in the Solomons that eventually Scott was able to break with his father and his beliefs and come to Australia, where eventually Scott became a theologian and a Uniting Church minister. And even though Scott was homeschooled by his father, he's now ridiculously overqualified academically, and he's able to order a beer in several dead ancient languages. Hello, Scott.
It's great to be here.
I've got to start by asking you about this amazing background, because a colleague here just said, you've got to talk to this guy, because his background's amazing. Where is home? Do you feel more American or Australian these days?
Definitely more Australian, but I suppose that there's this kind of deep nomadic impulse. Actually, to be perfectly frank, I'm not sure if I've ever felt really at home any place. I'm certainly more here than I was there. I haven't been back to the U.S. for quite some time. And this definitely is where I've sunk down roots.
Whereabouts in the U.S. did you grow up?
I was born in Cincinnati, which is, you know, kind of typical, you know, the working manufacturing belt. Then grew up just outside of Boston in New England, but then spent the last around about 10 years that we lived there, about 45 minutes away from New Orleans, or what used to be New Orleans, used to be the lovely Gulf Coast.
To go from New England to the Deep South must have been an interesting change, too.
It was, because you go from that sort of highly educated, cultured Northeast to, you know, I don't want to be too disparaging, but exactly the opposite in the Southeast. Louisiana is a remarkable place. It's got a deep and a very vibrant type of popular culture. It mixes all sorts of different elements and nationalities and backgrounds. But at the same time, you know, it's a place that has to be seen to be believed. Once you get outside of New Orleans, you would swear that you were in a third world country. It just has none of the attributes that people most often associate with cultural life in the United States.
Now you were your dad's first child, but not his first child.
Yeah.
Look, so to speak.
I think probably more now than ever before, my dad's a complete conundrum to me. He was one of two children, grew up very independent, very much alone, self-obsessed in terms of his study and his career advancement. And yet, inexplicably, in the last year of his PhD, and for anyone who's done a PhD, that last year is the time when you're thinking daily about killing yourself because of the, you know, the extraordinary pressure. In the last year of his PhD, he became, in the state of Maryland, the first single foster parent of six teenage boys.
Single foster parent? Teenage boys?
A single foster parent of six teenage boys. That's right. So he was.
Where were these kids from?
They were all from the local YMCA. He was one of the floor masters. You know, his job, it was the way that he got cheap board and was able to fund himself through his PhD. And he just became incredibly attached to these boys, fell in love with them and them with him, and then applied to foster all six of them.
So they were around when they were already part of the family when you were born?
Yes, four of them were. When my father and mother got married, they applied to adopt all six of them, but they were only given permission to adopt four. So it was the six of them, my parents, and then four of the boys went off on their honeymoon together. It was an extended camping trip.
Yeah, to actually adopt the foster kids is an interesting step. Yeah. I mean, you know, if he clearly had affection for them and would look after them, but to adopt them, did the decision to adopt, I don't know, did that spring from, did he have profound religious faith at that stage? Was that driving that, do you think?
I mean, he certainly did, although I can't really say much of anything about his faith as a graduate student. I mean, he came from a very strict Presbyterian background. His mother, certainly my grandmother, was the one that really nurtured and fed his faith. He didn't really get any of it from his father. But look, he's just sometimes he can be an extraordinarily hard man. I suppose that's who I grew up knowing. And then he'll display these extraordinary moments of almost self-sacrificial compassion and generosity. And four of these boys were the recipients of that. But I think, Richard, something that, again, I didn't really realize this until the last few years, one of the early traumas of his life, one of the things that still, you know, leaves its mark upon him, was having to choose which four. Which two do I say I love you, but not as much as the others? And that really marked him deeply. But like with many things, when something affects him deeply, he never speaks about it again. He runs away from it and I think represses it to, you know, such a level that it's almost as though it never happened.
So that's your dad. How about your mum? Because your parents sound like they were the original odd couple.
Oh, my father, I mean, he is the Republican stereotype.
He's got the haircut. He looks like Matt Damon in The Good Shepherd, doesn't he?
That's right. I mean, truly, I mean, when I watched Good Shepherd, it was quite a traumatic experience for me because I thought, good God, here he is. So he's your typical stiff upper lip, blue-blooded, New England-based Americans. You know, ancestors go back to the signing of the Constitution. My mother is part German, part Jewish, part North American Indian, from a highly dysfunctional family. She is your stereotypical peacenik. I mean, literally, she drove a VW Bug. She studied cultural anthropology at Georgetown University. She had posters of Martin Luther King and JFK on her walls. She ended up becoming a tutor in English and sociology at Sidwell Friends School, which is the school where Richard Nixon sent his children. She taught his children, where Christopher Hitchens currently sends his children. So she's this, and she was an anti-war protester. I mean, talk about an odd couple. They loathed what one another believed, and the only thing that actually brought them together was the fact that they were both in a young adults program at a local Presbyterian church in Washington, D.C.
What was your dad doing? What was his chosen career to begin with?
It was mechanical engineering. His PhD, I don't know, I mean, I couldn't understand this stuff if my life depended on it. But from what I understand, he had two supervisors, one in cardiology and the other in robotics. And part of his PhD was to try to design some kind of early detection system to pick up heart murmurs that would then anticipate heart failure, heart attack, cardio arrest. So that was his main area, but that then translated very quickly into robotics. He was an extraordinary mind in robotics, computer-aided manufacturing and design.
Do you know how he was brought into the CIA? Did he put his hand up or was he recruited?
No, he was in fact drafted. This is what happened during Vietnam. Young American men that were, I mean, unfortunately, this is a fairly disgraceful part of American history on a whole lot of levels, but uneducated men were drafted into the front line of the war, whereas those who were regarded as better educated, they tended to be of a particular area of the United States as well. They tended to be Northeast, were drafted into intelligence. And he was drafted directly into the CIA to work in their biological warfare kind of division. Mosquitoes was his thing.
Mosquitoes,
which, talk about something that fed his paranoia. We grew up believing, good God, we grew up believing, I mean, he told us repeatedly that he couldn't find a single disease that mosquitoes couldn't carry. So we grew up believing that it was just a matter of time before there was a HIV/AIDS epidemic like the world had never seen, born by Mosquitoes.
He really believed that?
He really believed that.
What? I wonder what research he was seeing. Was he? I don't even know what to say to that. That's extraordinary. So I'm also interested in the fact that he was there with the CIA and your mum being who she was, because I read a bit about the CIA in the 60s, and there's no end to how interesting that is that in that time, and the Good Shepherd sort of touches on that.
Yeah.
It was a kind of home for bohemians,
yes.
The CIA. A lot of bohemians became anti-communists and joined the CIA. So it was socially a really weird and interesting place, and nearly everyone became paranoid.
They did, and the one group that my father always spoke to us about, and you know, I mean, Richard, in some ways, this is a great way to grow up. You know, he would tell us, "Okay, kids, let me tell you who really killed JFK." I mean, this was sort of average conversation for us. It was fantastic.
Well, what did he say?
Well, according to him, there was this group, and I know this sounds preposterous. This sounds like some kind of, you know, B-grade Hollywood flick. But there was a group widely known by these middle-class bohemians and straight-laced conservatives within the CIA that were known as the Spooks. And they were people, boys who were taken out of orphanages, no parents, no identifiable background, trained in black ops.
Like janissaries.
Yes. And my father was a, you know, virulent JFK hater. He just, I even remember him saying that, you know, it was a good thing that JFK was assassinated, because otherwise his reputation would have been completely trashed. People only think he's a good president because he wasn't a president very long, which, you know. And then my mom, you know, she's the, you know, she had JFK on her wall as a university student. So anyway, he used to say that it was the Spooks that were leading a secret ground invasion in Cuba, that the official beachhead, the official ground invasion, was a diversion.
The Bay of Pigs.
The Bay of Pigs, for the Spooks doing another invasion, and they were going to try to assassinate Castro. At the last minute, apparently, well, I mean, this is a matter of public record, but the last minute, JFK called off the airstrike that was supposed to prepare the way, and apparently the entire contingent of Spooks were gunned down. My father said that the air in the CIA the next day was thick and toxic. And, you know, he said, you know, he's read all the books and he's seen what, you know, he's read about what happened. And he said, that's a spook operation from top to bottom.
The people in the CIA at that time were mad. They were quite mad. The whole plan was mad.
That's right.
And they thought that somehow it wouldn't be seen as a US-backed thing if they didn't put US military colors on the planes and the whatever. The whole thing was mad. And he was, absolutely, and Kennedy right. was, Kennedy sacked key people in the agency. So your dad was saying that climate.
Yes.
Was engendered by Kennedy not going through with wholeheartedly with the Bay of Pigs, and that's what led to his assassination.
That's right. That's what he said.
Yeah. But then your dad also said that HIV was born by mosquitoes.
That's right. So, you know, take your pick.
That's fantastic. What do you think the attraction was between your parents? I know that's a weird thing to ask the son of two parents. Maybe I shouldn't ask you that, but it just seems really interesting. Was it the otherness, I suppose?
My mum was completely fixated on him. I mean, she absolutely adored him, and you know, I mean,
he was brilliant, wasn't he?
He was apparently. I can't really comment on my father's attractiveness, but apparently, people found him, you know, quite intoxicating. He drove a Corvette convertible; that was his, you know. So, from his end, though, I mean, I adore my mother, but I cannot understand what someone of his political convictions, what someone of his personal convictions, and also, I'm sorry, but he was known as a bit of a womanizer. I mean, he dated several kind of former Miss Maryland contestants or Miss Illinois contestants or whatever. I mean, he loved apparently being seen with an attractive woman on his arm. And I love my mum to bits, but she's not a tall, leggy brunette. She's a, you know, a fairly frumpy looking peacenik. Look, I don't know. A little hypothesis that I've had, and this might stem more from The Godfather than anything else. For many men of my father's generation, there's a sort of woman that you date, and there's a sort of woman that you marry and rear your kids. Look, he always described to us that he loathed every second of being there. The environment was toxic. At the best of times, the interpersonal relations weren't good. But I think also, and this is something that probably doesn't resonate with us, with Australians, quite as much. Even in the most loyal, patriotic Americans, there is still a deep distrust of government. And
that's the Tea Party movement.
Yes, it is. You know? And look, I mean, my father is a very much an anti-establishment kind of person. He's not in favor of smaller groupings or communes or alternative ways of life. There's the individual, and then there's the oppressive state. And I think that begins to explain why, as soon as he was out of the CIA, as soon as he and my mother began to establish something like a more kind of normal life together, they withdrew us as a family from virtually every dimension of civil society, of those kind of mediating institutions that stand between individuals and state.
And that meant you were homeschooled.
It meant homeschooling. It meant no church. It meant
no church.
Because, you see, church is also corrupt. A church is full of people who don't really believe, and the world out there is a dangerous, terrifying place. And if I allow my children outside of my protective, you know, grasp, then someone's going to seize them. Someone's going to lead them astray.
Your dad sounds there's these disparate, different aspects of him. He's a purist in that sense.
Absolutely.
He didn't want you to be contaminated by
absolutely.
The world.
That's right.
Contaminated at all. Nonetheless, do you think you benefited from being homeschooled and being kept detached from these institutions?
This is a bit of a strange paradox for me. I detested homeschooling. I mean, as a young man, my dream was to be in class. The first class I ever sat in was at university. And I couldn't understand why people around me weren't paying, you know, this kind of rapt attention. Can you imagine the joy of sitting in a class and learning with other people from someone who's remotely interesting? But at the same time, I guess I have to acknowledge that those skills and those qualities and those virtues are kind of not just a self-discipline, but an ability to try to pick things up on my own if I don't know them. These are all virtues that I simply could not have had not my mother and father given that kind of attention and given me that kind of, I suppose, discipline and training growing up.
You're obviously a very bright guy. Did you read everything you could?
Well, I mean...
You're sheltered from interesting books.
Oh, of course. Of course. And music. No music growing
up
either. No music. Again, I mean, my father had this thing about, you know, sort of, you know, tribal drums weakening willpower. No. Seriously, though, Richard, that was it. It was drums, and it was the fluoride in the water. I hope I'm not making any kind of political. But we only ever drank bottled water as well, because everyone knows, he would say, that the fluoride in the water weakens willpower, increases compliance to the state, blah, blah.
So you all lived by the Old Testaments. What did that mean, then?
It meant, for instance, that our dietary observances were very, very strict. No pork, no shellfish, nothing like that. We strictly observed what he called the Sabbath. I mean, for Jews, the Sabbath is Friday evening to Saturday. For us, it was very, very strictly on Monday, which meant quite literally no work. I mean, one of the few moments that I actually felt as a young man that I was beginning to break out of the confines of home. I was part of a intramural basketball league, and I made the state team. But because their practices were on Sunday, I was pulled out immediately. So it really was extremely, extremely strict.
When did you start to question that? I mean, you're there in this kind of strange bubble, I suppose. When did you start to brush up against all that?
Look, I'm not sure, to be perfectly frank, if questioning was ever really part of who I was as a young man. I can honestly say that I didn't have a rebellious bone in my body towards my parents. I mean, I idolized my father. I adored my mother. I suppose the greatest difficulty for me growing up wasn't, you know, feeling this kind of oppressive blanket that lay over our lives. The real difficulty for me was the sense, this abiding sense, that I could not please my father in either who I was or in what I did. Mathematics is something that I just, you know, it's just something, unless it's incredibly theoretical, I just can't get my head around it. Same with science. He wanted a young mechanical engineer who was going to keep on the family tradition. And one of the jokes we used to tell growing up is that my younger sister is the son that he never had. She works for Caterpillar. She's their senior production designer. She's a mechanical engineer to the, you know, to the very bottom. And I suppose that was the real, that was, I don't want to speak in unnecessarily pathetic terms, but that was the agony for me. I couldn't please him. And I knew that the career choice. I knew that what I felt called to really wasn't going to sit very well with him.
So if your dad was shaking his fist and raging at the imperfections of the outside world, did he rage at your imperfections too?
Yeah, yeah. Look, one of the... you should never talk to me about the virtues of homeschooling. There are many things I'm very grateful for about it, but I think you need a particular parental temperament. One of the difficulties growing up was the line between parent-teacher, the line between disappointment and anger, and the line between some kind of retribution and out-and-out punishment were blurred constantly. My father brought me up the way that his father brought him up, which was involving fairly intense physical discipline right up to the time that I was in my mid-teens.
Did he ever go too far with that?
Yeah. Yeah. Thankfully, I think, and again, I'm not trying to sound sort of stupid or heroic or anything, but it was more so me than it was my sisters, thank God, but also my youngest sibling, my little brother. There was one incident where he was hurt really badly, and I think for that put the fear of God into my father. He sort of it shook him up a bit, and things got much, much better after that.
But your father, as you say, was capable of acts of wonderful compassion. Mm. And tell me about your brother Timothy.
When I was three, obviously I don't remember the event. I remember Timothy well. My parents, with four adopted sons already, then I was born. When I was three, they adopted a young boy. He was 2 years old. Timothy, he had chronic cystic fibrosis, an incredibly, incredibly sick little boy. I don't know how they got in contact with my parents, but I think something of my father's, record became known, and an agency contacted my parents and said, "Is there room for one more?" That was with the full proviso that Timothy probably wouldn't see out the next 6 months. Just an incredibly, incredibly sick and sickly-looking boy. He ended up living a beautiful, joyous, I mean, always plagued life right up until he was 8 years old. It wasn't until after I left home that I even knew that he was adopted. We were within 12 months of one another and thick as thieves. It was a terrific way to grow up with someone like him.
So there you are with your father and your mum, and your dad's this extraordinary man. He's with the CIA. And then he gives it all away. He gave it away and became like Harrison Ford in The Mosquito Coast.
There is I should probably just correct you a little bit. He was only in the CIA for a short period of time. I think it was about 6 to 7 years. The rest of his time was with the university, University of Southwestern Louisiana. He was chair of mechanical engineering and head of the robotics program.
But he got jack of everyone and left.
He did. And strangely enough, at the height of his career, I mean, he literally had reached the pinnacle of what he could achieve professionally. And then in 1989, I mean, he always had restless, he's a restless person. He always had itchy feet. We never had a house, for instance. He never had any money in the bank and never got a loan. He didn't trust banks. He didn't...
Yeah, if he doesn't trust churches, how's he going to be with banks?
He didn't. So I mean, seriously, he had under his bed a little metal box, and he changed all of his... money that wasn't sort of needed for liquid cash. He changed it into gold coin. He had gold bullion in an unsecure metal box underneath his bed, and so everything was always paid for cash. He didn't like being nailed down to a house, and so we lived in a caravan. The entire crew of us lived in this huge caravan, so that if he wanted to, he could just back up the truck, hook it onto the trailer, and we'd be off.
Which, and he did.
Which we did for 3-4 months of the year.
Do you remember he made this... Do you remember when he was going to make this radical move to the other side of the world? Do you remember the speech he made? Did he just walk in one day and say, "We're all going to the Solomon Islands"?
No. In 1987, we'd taken a trip as a family. Our first overseas family vacation to, yes, everyone's favorite holiday destination, the Solomon Islands. And he had no idea why he was going there. He became fixated with it. I mean, he knew everything there was to know about Guadalcanal and the battles during World War II. But none of us had any idea, not even my mother had any idea why we were there. And look, he believes that he felt this deep, deep sense that God was calling us as a family to sell everything, to leave the catastrophe, the calamity that was imminently to befall the United States, and to take refuge on this island in the South Pacific.
And what was he going to do? He's going to be to do what?
When we went for a visit in 87, he had no idea. He was actually just looking for land. He was wondering, you know, where can I build us a little sanctuary, a little fort?
So you all go off, pack off and go to the Solomon Islands, and that's when your dad becomes a teacher. Why a teacher? What was the appeal for him in that?
I think at that stage, when we first moved there, it was just expedience. He had to leave a large pension behind at the university. If he had seen it through for just another 5 years, he would have had much more in his retirement fund. He resigned himself to the fact that, you know, we weren't going to be able to live off our own steam. So shortly after arriving there, he met the principal of a Church of Melanesia secondary school. The Church of Melanesia is the South Pacific equivalent of the Church of England. And they hit it off, and he said that my father and mother had just the qualifications that they need. I'm talking about overqualified, just the qualifications that they need, that the school needed for science and maths and social studies and English. So both of my parents were hired to be secondary school teachers on Guadalcanal.
And how about you? What changed in your life once you'd gone there?
The thing, probably more than anything else, that affected me deeply. I mean, I was 15, just turned 16, just about to turn 16 when we arrived there. And this was a community, Richard. I mean, this school campus was a community like none that I'd ever encountered before. I mean, my secondary schooling was basically done. I had sat my university entrance exams in the United States, so I'd qualified for entry to university. There was nothing to do during that year that I lived with them in the Solomons, apart from enjoy the life of that community. So I would go with the students into the fields and pick cassava and plant potato, and it was an extraordinary experience for me because, I mean, there was something big and rich and wonderful outside of the life of the family. And I think, actually, to correct something I said before, I felt at home there. It was magnificent. And the decision to leave was a very, very hard one.
It was some Anglican missionaries that changed your view on religion. Tell me about them and how that happened for you.
They didn't change my view of religion.
Or people with religion then. Yeah. Like, yeah.
Look, the tension growing up was always between my father and my mother. My mother was a Quaker. She had this kind of rich background in this great mystical literature of the Christian church going back 500 years. She melded that with a kind of beautifully leftist, generous approach to the world and a love of poetry and art and languages and everything else. And my father is this Presbyterian, austere, pure. And so, my mum was always handing me stuff to read. And I think what she knew, and we talked about this all the time, is that the only sense of vocation that I ever had growing up was, I don't know what this means, but I know that I want to be involved in the life of the church. I know that the church has got something to do with what I'm going to end up doing. At the time, I couldn't quite interpret that in terms of becoming ordained or becoming a priest or a minister, because the ministers that I'd seen were all way too much like my father, bit larger than life, bombastic, ungiving, unyielding. So the tension that I suppose I had was, I had never seen a positive example of what an adult Christian might look like. And at the same time, my mum's giving me this kind of gloriously romantic literature that just didn't square at all with what I, you know, with the sort of Christian environment that I grew up in. I met some spectacular people from the Anglican Diocese of Sydney in the Solomon Islands.
Spectacular in what way?
They were down to earth. They were common folk. They were hardworking. Their sense of Christianity, though, translated into an intense love for the students there at the school, translated into a desire to be of service rather than, you know, to be the great white hope that were coming to bring life and enlightenment to this backward island, which in some ways is the way that my father understood his vocation as a teacher there. You know, he was bringing light to these poor, dark students.
White man's burden, all that.
The white man's burden, that's exactly it. And look, there was just something about them. Not that I had much to compare it with, but there was something about them. And I just thought, you know, this is pretty good. So
I love the fact that a couple of nice Anglican missionaries from Sydney turned you, you know, corrupted you, took you away from the path of purity. I think that's lovely.
That's exactly right. So my father had designs for me to return to the University of Arizona to study chemical engineering. He had enrolled me. I don't think he quite went so far as getting the tickets. And all the while, for about 4 months, my mother and I were I just said, I want to move to Australia and I want to study theology in Sydney. So the moment came, and again, Richard, you know, I love this guy. I love my father. And I could see the disappointment in his face. And I knew that something was going to irreversibly change between us.
So what was that conversation like then when you told him you were going to Australia to study?
I was fearing the worst. When we had had anything like those sorts of conversations in the past, they ended up becoming physical. I feared the worst. He didn't say anything, which was the hardest thing of all. He left the room, didn't speak to me for quite some time. And then there was a brief moment of affection in the form of, you know, putting his hand on my shoulder at the airport. And then that was it.
So then you were off to theological college in Sydney. Mm. What were you like? You must have been incredibly naive in some ways and overeducated in others. Were you a bit of a fish out of water there?
Yeah. The only place I'd heard of in Sydney was Moore Theological College. Most of the students who go to that college are they've changed course midlife, so they're mid to late 30s, the age that I am now. They have been lawyers and doctors and whatever else, and then because of their experience within the Anglican Church there, they feel some sort of call to go into or the ordained ministry. I was the youngest student there by 17 years, and for God's sake, a homeschooled 17-year-old American.
Who thinks mosquitoes transmit HIV. Yeah.
I never quite bought that. That just seemed too weird to me. But I mean, again, Richard, for me, this was like, I couldn't care less what the rest of the students thought of me. This was like the Garden of Eden. There was a library there that I spent every spare moment sitting in, reading everything that I could. The opportunity to study in this way, to study things that I thought really, really, really counted. Was just magnificent. And I loved every moment.
You were apprenticed to another minister who was a wonderful man, and he broadened your mind on a few things too, didn't he?
Towards the end of my first year at Moore, I began as an independent student, but towards the end of that year, very, very generously, the college approached me about training for ordained ministry within the Anglican Church. The beginning of my second year, I was, like you said, apprenticed at this tiny church outside of Liverpool, in Sydney. It's a Holy Trinity in Casula. A man was brought out of retirement to look after a church that had really had a very, very hard time of things with its previous ministers. And he was this gracious, godly, gentle, humble man. One incident that left a deep impression on me that resonated with some of the things that I'd experienced in the Solomon Islands. He gave me a call in the men's quarters there at Moore College early one Saturday morning, said, "Get on the train. We're going to go visiting some congregants." And he said, "Wear your worst clothes." Okay. He picked me up from the train station. And he was wearing knee-high rubber boots, and he had two shovels with him. And he said, "Jack," one of the older parishioners, "his septic tank has just ruptured.
Oh.
We're going to go dig it out for him and talk to him about faith." And Richard, it was fantastic.
Oh, no, it wasn't.
No, well,
it
was awful, but it was fantastic because all of the worst images that I'd ever had of what it meant to be a Christian adult in that moment were kind of exploded, that being Christian and being in the service of the church didn't mean becoming some sort of dogmatic wowser who's only obsessed with yours and others' purity. It actually meant in some way looking for Jesus in the most bizarre places and actually trying to be of more service to people rather than just standing above them and telling them what to do.
You're in line to become an Anglican minister. Why didn't you graduate?
I did graduate. I graduated from Moore very, very well. It was the other aspect of the course that I didn't do quite so well at. Look, I bear no ill feelings towards Moore College. I love my time there. I bear no ill feelings towards the Sydney Diocese. That diocese shaped so much of what I understand about what it means to be a Christian. And yet as my studies progressed, and this might have been part of my father kind of coming out in me, there was this hard line that came through from every side of our theological education. This is the line that you take out with you as a minister. It wasn't teaching you how to think. It was teaching you what to think. It wasn't giving you the resources to try to explore the depths of the Christian faith or the history of Christian thought. It was arming you, if you like, with a specific content that would make you sound very, very smart. And yet all the way through, I'm just thinking, you know, you're sending people out that sound smart, but have disengaged with what it means to really grapple with the Christian faith and Christian life. And it was the heavy-handedness of it and the way that it seemed to me that ministers were standing over their congregations and beating the living daylights out of them every time they opened up the scriptures and treating quite often a very lower class group of people as if they all were part of the North Shore of Sydney. It just didn't resonate with me. And inside, I'm kind of, you know, groaning and straining at the edges. And it was in my final year that I began reading a philosopher who would change me deeply. And that was the great 19th century German philosopher Georg Hegel. Some of his ideas about the church and the state and the nature of the Christian life following Jesus sent me off on these wonderful, wonderful new directions. So, you know, as a young man of 21, I fronted my last ordination panel. It's being chaired by Peter Jensen. And, you know, stupidly and precociously and naively, just tried to, you know, unburden my conscience. Right. These are my reflections. This is what I've experienced in parish life. And these are some of the things that just aren't sitting very well with me. I was told at that time that they had been observing for a while that some of my essays, and this is a bizarre idea, that my essays were then being circulated among the people who had ordained me. Yes, we've noticed that you've been taking some worrying directions in some of your essays. And it concluded when I was told, son.
Son?
Son. Anyway, that pressed all sorts of buttons for me as well. Son, this is not a dialogue. This is not a conversation. We're not going to compromise here. You come to where we are, or we don't ordain you.
Can you have any kind of religious institution without dogma? I mean, you're railing against dogma. That's what it is, isn't it? Just take this, holus bolus. You'll just have to accept this. Isn't that going to always be the core of any kind of religious institution?
No, no. Dogma is a wonderful thing. Dogma is something that is like a thunderclap. It shakes you out of prior certainties. But good dogma within the Christian tradition, within some of the great religious traditions of the world, good dogma has always created a space for thought and raging against the edges. The best theologians have always been people who actually raged against those prior certainties and in so doing expanded the boundaries of what could and could not be believed.
But haven't you got the kind of mind that's quite penetrating? You do. So it's really obvious even talking to you that you might have a core of dogma and you say, well, let's play around with the fringes. I reckon you'd get right to the center, I reckon, and pull that apart too, wouldn't you?
My understanding of the Christian faith is that because Jesus is at the center of it, that already the center is shifting and changing, becoming uncomfortable. One of the great influences on me is the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams. He said, and this is something that's imprinted itself on my soul, he said, Jesus Christ is no dead hero. He is a living stranger. And I think one of the difficulties that I was having in those final years of theological college, Jesus had been far too domesticated. This was an upper middle class, well-educated North Shore Jesus that was then becoming a taskmaster to lower class communities and congregations. And I couldn't stand the thought of it. It felt to me like a betrayal of everything that Christianity was about.
You love engaging with Marxists and atheists.
Absolutely.
Do you have anything, What can you say? What can you really say to an atheist? Because won't you always be arguing in a parallel line with an atheist? You believe in God and Christ is the Son of God, and an atheist just thinks that's nonsense.
Mm.
How can you ever find any point of contact?
The thing that I keep going back to, and this was, again, something that began growing on me at the end of my studies, and it was incredibly unpopular. You know who the first people to be called atheists were? The first occurrence of the word atheists was used by Romans in the first century to describe Christians. And the reason that they called Christians atheists was because Christians didn't worship any god that was recognizable in the culture around them. There's this wonderful graffiti that's been discovered at the bottom of the Roman Colosseum in the guards' quarters. It portrays a kind of male figure up on the wall with a donkey's head. This male figure is hanging on a cross, and scrawled in letters beneath it, you know, with a little stick figure seemingly bowing the knee, is Alexamenos worships his god. Now that was the first statement of atheism. If you worship something that is unworthy, that is preposterous, that is ridiculous, that by definition is atheistic. I have these debates all the time, and I've often said that I feel far more in common with the likes of Freud and Marx and Darwin and Hegel and Kierkegaard, these great, I mean, not all of them purely, strictly speaking, atheists, but, you know, with these strong critiques of religion running through their thought, I feel far more commonality with that than I do with so much domesticated, weak, predictable Christian theology. Because it seems to me that what Christianity has on its center, and this is what I mean when I say that Jesus is at the center, Christianity is always challenging, okay, but what sort of God are you talking about? When you say, I believe in God, what sort of God are you talking about? When you say, there is no God, what sort of God are you talking about? And I think this is the great Christian revolution. God is not a self-obvious concept. It takes definition. I think that Christianity has got that definition just about right.
There's so many questions that I have from that. I think someone like Richard Dawkins wouldn't recognize that definition of an atheist. He's, you know, the definition of the atheist is someone who believes in no God that we can recognize. Someone like Richard Dawkins would say, I don't believe in any God at all, at all, none of that. So that's not quite right, is it? If someone like – you've actually met Richard Dawkins. Have you had that conversation with him?
Oh, no. And our meeting was very, very, very fleeting. No, I haven't. But you see, again, when Richard Dawkins says, I don't believe in any God at all, he talks quite overtly about that grand being out there that pulls strings, that runs shows, that's beyond time and space, that somehow surpasses the bounds of human knowledge. When he talks about faith, he's talking about this kind of preposterous leap into the void, trying to overcome necessary doubt by means of false and illusory certainties. Many people have said this about Dawkins, and I need to tell you, Richard, I was at a conference a couple of years ago on the God delusion. They had invited various speakers to take on the book. I was so disgusted during the conference with what some of the Christian kind of apologists were saying about Dawkins. I thought they were badly misrepresenting him. I had the closing address. I ended up defending him because I think there is so much in Dawkins' critique of what he defines as religion that is absolutely right. And in fact, my only real criticism of Dawkins is that he's standing on the shoulders of these great Christian theologians who have made similar critiques, but he doesn't quite realize it. I just think he needs to broaden his reading a little bit.
It sounds like you like the idea of religion as a provocation as opposed to a comfort. But isn't it true most people really do seek comfort from religion rather than being asked to question very, very deep and fundamental things all the time?
Yeah. I do see religion as far more of a comfort, and as far more of a provocation, and it's one of my gripes that people tend to try to make God and try to adopt forms of faith that really do, if you like, begin to conform to their own image. They make a God that looks very much like them.
That's very human.
It is incredibly human, but I think it's not simply human. It's also so much a product of the kind of society that we live in today. I mean, one of the things, if you like, that really bothers me is we have the state, the government, we have individuals who are loaded with choice, with opportunities to make themselves and to redefine their lives. And what we're missing, what almost none of us have recognized, is there are supposed to be these things that have grown up in between. Things like family, communities, things like churches and organizations, things that used to be called civil society. And I suppose civil society is precious to me because that's the very thing that I never had. There was the state that my father hated that runs schools and pumps fluoride into the water. And then there was just us. And I think there's this intense, beautiful, forming network of relationships that stand in between. I guess my problem is we've allowed ourselves the opportunity to make religions that suit us. And if I don't like that, fine, I'll get in my car and go down the road to another church where it suits me a bit better. And if I don't like that, then the whole thing just keeps moving. It's that sense of obligation where it's not simply that we want something that comforts us, but we join something that then obliges us to the lives of others.
Gee, it's been great to speak with you today, Scott. You're a fascinating guy. I wish I could talk for you for another half an hour. Thank you so much for being my guest in conversation.
It's a pleasure, Richard. Anytime.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.